I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Have you thought about how you want to spend your last moments on Earth? Our guest, Alua Arthur, has. She wants to be in her bed outside on a deck, taking in the smells, sights, and sounds of the world. She wants to hear the quiet chatter of the people she loves with a murmuring creek in the background. Alua Arthur is a death doula, a kind of midwife for the end of life, providing a range of non-medical supportive services, everything from taking care of paperwork to being a compassionate listener. She spent many hours with her clients as they share their most intimate hopes and dreams, fears and regrets. She writes in her book, Briefly, Perfectly Human, that people have three concerns as they face death. Who did I love? How did I love? Was I loved? She's come to believe that sharing our most vulnerable feelings about death is, paradoxically, a secret to living a good and meaningful life. She's founder of Going with Grace, that's a training program for doulas, and an end-of-life planning organization. She joins us on The Connection today to talk about embracing our mortality. Alua Arthur, nice to have you with us on the show. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
I'm glad to hear that you want to talk about death.
I do want to talk about death, especially with you. I read just a couple of sentences from your imagining how you want to die. You are very, very specific. It goes on for many paragraphs describing how you want to end your days. Why is it important to be so specific?
I think when we give ourselves an opportunity to really go there, to really just dive into how we would experience those last moments if we could, it allows us to experience a little bit of a freedom around it. You know, when I can say this is how I'd imagine it to go, this would be like the best case scenario, then it gives me something to, quote unquote, look forward to. And that sounds kind of bizarre when talking about my death, knowing that it must come. I would much rather imagine it in a way that brings me comfort rather than a way that's horrific or gives me anxiety. So many of us have so much fear around the how of our death. And rather than sit and broil in anxiety about it, why not imagine something beautiful, something that really serves me?
Well, you also say, and I really like this, I left my beloveds with one of the most important directives, to tell the truth about who I am. And I think we often either sort of sugarcoat the complicated people we have lived with, or just we do remember maybe the good stuff and oftentimes forget the more difficult stuff. But you say, tell the truth about me.
It would be the greatest honor to talk about me and my complexity. You know, not everybody lit up a room, right?
Right.
That's what we hear so often. She
right.
lit up every room she walked into.
Exactly.
You know, not everybody's feet were like gold. Not everybody left a lasting impact on everybody that they came across. Rather, when we allow people to be human, to be complex, to be fallible, to be messy, to be greedy and stingy and all the parts of who we are, I think it gives us more freedom to be in our full humanness as well. I also think that it would honor the life that I led. Mm-hmm. It would make my actions make a lot more sense if you said all of me rather than just the parts that people like and will miss.
You use the word choose. I mean, this is how you choose to die. But yeah. We don't often or always get to do that. We don't often or always get to control how we die. If you don't die like this, will you be disappointed?
I can't imagine I would be. I don't know that my consciousness will survive to be able to judge how I actually died. You know, we talk so much about the good death and having the good death, and I wonder who it is that we're performing for. Maybe the people that are left behind. I won't be disappointed. I don't think that the people that love me will be disappointed. But moreover, I think that how I live up until my death will be the thing that makes it a good death or not. So I'm going to do my best to live my life in such a way that whenever my death comes and however my death comes, not only am I prepared, but it also serves as the period at the end of a really, really beautiful sentence.
You write about some really debilitating depression that you have had in your life. I mean, to the point where you couldn't work. I'm just sort of deeply in mourning, in a sense, for a life that you really couldn't live. And I wonder whether that was a kind of, not death for you, but sort of living and dying at the same time.
It absolutely was a death. It was the death of a lot of different parts of me. It was the death of the person that thought that she would make a great legal aid lawyer. It was the death of some of my parents' dreams. It was the death of the expectation of myself out there in the world. And when I had to mourn it all, I had to put it down. Not only had my disease of depression no longer allowed me to engage in life the way that I would have liked to, so that I had no choice, I struggled with it because it meant admitting a lot of things about myself, that also I was sick. I think I held my mental health as a standard, as somewhat of like a badge of honor. Many of us are reticent to share mental health struggles, and I was reticent to share that I was deeply, deeply depressed. It was also like a social death of some sort to admit that I wasn't okay.
Yeah. You had this chance encounter, a kind of serendipitous encounter, I guess, in hindsight. You had left your job. You're in Cuba. You're riding on a bus with a woman you have never met before. She's actually dying of cancer, and she's traveling the world. She's decided, you know, this is how I want to end my life. And the two of you begin talking, and it literally did change your life. What was it about her? What did she say? What did you talk about that made this switch in how you were living your life?
There was so much about her. There was her openness. There was her gregariousness. There was her joy. There was her eagerness to dive into a topic that I think many people would shy away from. But when she shared with me that she had this serious illness, which I think many people wouldn't have done, it opened up something in me. And so I started asking her questions about her disease. I asked her about her life. I asked her about her death. I asked her about her regrets. I asked her about love. I asked her about failure. I asked her about all of it. And she went there. So that was the thing about her. She went there. She came along with me, even though, you know, a social convention would have it that you not ask those questions of a stranger. I struggle sometimes with that. I asked all the difficult questions and she answered.
Yeah.
It allowed me to think about, well, I was thinking about her end, but it shone the light back on my own end. So I started to think about my life too and my mortality and if my disease of depression would kill me, which depression can absolutely be a terminal illness when left untreated. Had my disease of depression killed me, would I be pleased with the life that I lived? How would I answer the same questions I was asking myself?
Yeah.
So all these things started bubbling up to the surface. They were uncomfortable, really, really uncomfortable to look at and to admit about myself, but it was time.
But it's so interesting. I mean, there must have been something about her and something about you, something about the chemistry between the two of you that allowed this conversation. I mean, she wouldn't have answered if she didn't feel some degree of comfort with you.
Yeah, she felt a lot of comfort with me right off the bat. Also because in a beautiful bit of serendipity, as I was making my way to the bus stop, a car almost hit me along the way and I slammed my hands on the hood and like, you know, get it together, Ilua. I made it to the bus stop on time. I started chatting with her in line and she offered to hold the bus for me so I could get on. When I got on the bus and we sat down, we started talking and this whole beautiful conversation unfolded. For 14 hours. She was only supposed to be on for 7, and then she stayed on for 7 more hours. Mm-hmm. Eventually, she got off the bus with me. We went to the Casa Particular that I'd rented, and as we went to bed that night, she shared with me that she had been in the car that had almost hit me in the street. And so when I showed up to the bus stop, she was very keen on meeting me. And I think once I started asking her questions, since she already had an idea about maybe who I was going to be in her life or she had some idea about who I was. It allowed her to open up, and then it opened me up in a beautiful way.
You say, you write about the burden of living an inauthentic life, and it sounds as if you were, you know, you were maybe living someone else's dreams, not your own, or hadn't sort of figured out what you wanted to do with your life, and feeling as if you were sort of going through the motions. But, the subtitle of your book is Making an Inauthentic Life by Getting Real About the End, which sort of encapsulates this chance meeting with this woman.
100%. Authenticity to me is one of the key principles. It's one of the ways that people get a little bit more comfortable with their death. You know, one of the major regrets is not living a life that was true to them on their deathbed. And so if every day I can live in my authenticity, I can choose for myself, then perhaps when I get there, I'll say, all right, we did it. There's nothing left. I left nothing on the table. And that doesn't mean going to climb Machu Picchu or go to see the Mona Lisa, but rather it means being honest with how I want to spend my time and who I want to be, etc. There was certainly a time, as you mentioned, where I was not living for myself.
Right.
I wasn't working the way that I would have wanted, etc. Now, I never could have guessed that it would become death work. That became what I did with my life, but it wasn't the practice of law, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. Well, sometimes things make sense when we look back on our lives, but you describe a very early memory of yours. You grew up in Ghana. You lived in Ghana as a young child. Your parents lived there. Your dad actually was a member of the parliament there. And one of an early memory you have is this civil war and being in your father's arms as you're fleeing, you know, for safety. He ended up actually serving something like 6 months in prison. But in hindsight, sort of to think that you began this life, your life, with, if not death, certainly danger.
Absolutely. You know, only as an adult was I able to go back and start piecing it together, because I think for many of us, our first memories aren't fully formed. There's like flashes of things where I can vaguely remember some sense. And what I remember the most was some panic going on. You know, I can see flashes of window panes. I can see my mom vaguely. I think she was holding one of my sisters. But I remember panic around, but my dad holding me, and I felt so sturdy and calm and safe in the midst of this incredible chaos. Only as an adult did I now understand that we were under significant threat that day, but I felt comfortable in the middle of all of it.
Yeah, and your dad served time in prison, did get out of prison, and move with your family to live in America.
Yeah, after his political detention, we had gotten status in the States as SLEs, political refugees. So we came to the States, and then he eventually joined us when he got out of prison and found his way to the States, which by a lot of serendipity as well.
A lot of serendipity. And where did you grow up? Where did you settle?
We started off in Bethesda, Maryland, where my youngest sister was born. From there, after my father joined us, we came to California, where he went to Fuller Theological Seminary because he became a minister and a preacher. He found Jesus while he was in political detention, and my mom had found Jesus simultaneously but separately. And so together they decided that we would become missionaries and we'd spread the world. We'd travel the world spreading Jesus. And so from there, we bounced around the globe a bit until we ended up back in Ghana for part of my adolescence, and then eventually in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
So you've seen, we're almost about to break here. You have seen a lot of the world.
I have, and I've kept traveling as an adult.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Alua Arthur. She is a death doula, and she wrote a book, came out just last year, called Briefly Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End. It is in part about her life, but it's also about the things that she has learned as she has sat with people who are dying, who are talking about their life as they look back over the many years, or maybe even the few years that they have lived it. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we're talking about how death makes life more meaningful. And our guest is Alua Arthur. She is a death doula and author of a book called Briefly Perfectly Human. Well, I'm not breaking any news, Alua, that we are all going to die someday. I mean, some sooner than others. Frankly, I think some more tragically than others. I always think of the death of a child as just sort of unbelievably tragic loss. And yet, we mostly do not talk about death, or we don't even want to think about it very much. What are we missing when we don't?
We're missing the opportunity to get really real about our lives, to create some context for why we live, for who we love, for how we want to show up in this world. We're also missing the opportunity to, you know, backstroke in the great mystery of our existence. To me, that's part of the fun part, and I use that word very, very lightly, about thinking about mortality, is I cannot find any reasonable explanation for this utter miracle that is birth and then the end of it, which is death. How is it that a human is here, they have sensations and thoughts and feelings and opinions and eat food and favorite foods and places to go and et cetera, and then in the space of a breath, gone. You know, the body returns to matter, eventually decomposes. That spark of life that was in them is gone. It's such a mystery. Yeah. And I think when we can really be with that mystery, it allows us to be a little bit more present in our lives, to take in this wonder that we exist at all.
I think we often want us to take the mystery out of mystery, which is to say, well, this is what it is. This is what it means. But you're saying the mystery is really the world that we're living in as we live our shorter, long times on this earth.
It's absolutely mysterious. The fact that you and I are talking right now in different cities and able to hear each other based on oxygen that's coming in and pushing up past my diaphragm through these vocal cords to make a series of sounds that you somehow understand and can either have an emotional connection to or create more questions from, that is mysterious. Mm-hmm. The very basic, the smallest little bits of being human are utterly mysterious and magical. And I think when we can settle in on that, it doesn't take away from the pain, from the destruction of children dying and war and famine and the rest by any means, but it does allow us to be a little bit more present with this gift of life that we've got while we've got it.
We're using words like death and dying, and there's so many euphemisms that we use, you know, passing away, left us, gone to a better place. It's just, you know, I could go on and on about the euphemisms that we use for these words, death and dying. Is it important to say death and dying, or are you okay with the euphemisms that we use?
You know, I'm pretty literal. I don't really understand idioms very well. Euphemisms often miss me entirely. Yeah. I think it's because English is my second language, but I don't get them. Once somebody shared with me that she'd lost her mother, and I thought, well, where did she go? How can we find her? You know, I feel so bad because she was sharing very earnestly. But when we use euphemisms, we deny the fact of what has occurred. A death has occurred. And for some, it's necessary to use a euphemism until they can get comfortable with what has actually happened. But the finality of the word death is very confronting for some. Yeah. I choose the word death doula to describe the work that I do, as opposed to an end-of-life doula or something of the sort, just to hone in what it is that we're actually talking about. We're talking about the end of our lives. We're talking about when we actually die.
Well, I must say, in preparation for the show, I thought a lot about death and certainly thinking about, you know, the wars that are happening, that have always happened as human beings have lived. The kind of sudden deaths that can happen, the accidents, the plane crashes, you know, there's a long list of things that can happen to us as we live, and learning to live with that uncertainty, the kind of mystery, but the uncertainty that comes with the mystery.
Our whole lives feel like a big, fat mystery. You know, it's all right. Very uncertain. We have this illusion of control or idea that we can control something, but I don't know what's going to happen second to second. I like to think I can. I like to try to control the things that I can, but the more I try to control, the harder it is for me to surrender into what actually is. And sometimes what is brutal, and that doesn't make it any better, you know, but it allows us to just be with what's occurring rather than wish it was something else. I see this often when people are diagnosed with a serious illness or they've been in treatment for a while, and the resistance to the end of their lives approaching or the resistance to a disease seems to cause a lot of suffering, more so than the illness itself, more so than having to do all the preparations for death. Now, if we could surrender into it, it's a tall order, but surrendering into it allows it to be a little bit more graceful.
What does that mean, surrender into it? And, you know, I don't think anyone really wants to die.
Some do.
I guess some do.
Some do for sure. Certainly some very elderly people or people that are in a lot of physical pain or mental, emotional pain. But aside from that, it's massive when folks get a diagnosis of some sort that says that their lives will soon be ending, to say this is where we are. But I often encourage my clients to work with a brief phrase that begins with today. That says, today I am, to describe their current experience that day. Today I have this disease. Today I have this diagnosis. It allows us to ground a little bit more in the present of what's occurring rather than being elsewhere. You know, the mind can wander. Everything can wander. I can wish and hope and dream, but I have to live in reality. I have to live present with what's going on in my life. And when I can ground myself in today, it allows me to just be with it. It's not easy.
No, I was going to say.
It's not easy at all.
Because the impulse is to push it away, is to deny it, is to think about something else, pretend it's not happening.
Yeah, but that denial, well, let's ground it in what happens with the bodies in the medical care system. That denial often means that people are getting treatment all the way up until the end, treatment that is brutal and difficult for the body, rather than allowing them to live a little bit more comfortably, to maybe have a little bit more energy, to be with the fact that their lives are ending, as opposed to living in resistance to it and continuing to get treatment all the way up until the end. My brother-in-law, for example, my older sister's husband died, and that is one of the great ways that I got to see how this work shows up in the world and also allowed me to be very much with my grief. When he was dying, they treated him almost all the way up until the end. Peter died in a hospital. He never had a chance to go to hospice. He never got all the supportive services that come with hospice because the doctors kept trying. There was always something new. Whereas realistically, had they stopped trying to treat him 3 months earlier, maybe he could have died at home the way that he wanted, surrounded by those that he really cared for. He could have had a chance to say goodbye. We would have had more time to write out his plans, to hold a ceremony of some sort, to tell him how much I loved him and the impact that he had on my life, rather than walk out thinking he was going to get another treatment and then he fell unconscious.
You know, and it's that was such a tragic loss for you, and also, in a sense, put you on this path to being a death doula. It also reminds me when my mother died, which was more than 20 years ago, and again, multiple treatments in the hospital, and then she finally did say, she mouthed the words because she couldn't speak, "I want to die." And it was, I mean, sad, of course, but also courageous and bold, and sort of fought against the medical system that kept saying, oh, no, there's just one more treatment. If we do one more treatment, we can fix all of this. And she said, you know what? I'm done. And so we were able to actually be with her and as she died, which was such a gift. So sad, but such a gift.
I'm both heartened and sad to hear this. Yeah. You know, on the one hand, I'm so sad that she had to fight for it, obviously, that she died, but also really encouraged that she said enough. Mm-hmm. And often people get to that point, you know, they say, let's stop this because this is not working. That is a surrender into it.
Yeah.
That's a surrender into saying, hey, my body has done the best that it can. Medicine has done the best that it can. And now it's time for me to die. It's a tough one.
It sure is. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Elua Arthur, and she is a death doula, helping people as they go through the process of dying, sometimes taking care of very practical things, sometimes dealing with some spiritual issues or even psychological support. And again, wrote a book last year called Briefly, Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End. And she is passionate about the fact that we need to talk about death and our own death and the death of the people that we love and care for. I think for a lot of people, it's like, how do you be with someone who's dying? And I remember that, you know, how do you want to fix something? You want to do something. You say, show up and shut up.
With love.
With love. Explain what you mean. Describe that.
You already made a super astute observation, which is that we want to fix it. We want to make it better somehow. Yet there is no fixing the pain of grief or death or loss. There's no fixing it whatsoever. I think most of us desire just being witnessed, just having somebody with us, not somebody to make it all go away. If somebody could make it go away, that would be amazing. But words can't fix the pain of my own mortality, you know? It's important that we allow our human friends, our people that we're journeying with, to just be exactly where they are, to try to not say the words, to bring them out of it, or to avoid saying the thing that may be difficult for them because we don't want them to feel pain. I'm not that powerful. What I am, though, what is more powerful, rather, is just to be able to acknowledge that somebody is suffering and to allow them to be in that place as long as they can. It also means that I must trust the person that I'm with, that they will do what they need to do in order to get themselves to the place where they feel better, or they'll stay there, and that's what they need at that time. Now I have to trust them. I also have to trust myself and trust that, you know, I can allow them to be where they are. It's tough, but when people are in deep grief, you know, we always want to say something,
yeah.
And often these platitudes end up making it worse. Like, when she's in a better place, well, how do you not know that the very best place for her is not right by that person's side? You know, it's one that is really hard to take. We want to say the things that are helpful, but often they cause more harm. So better to show up, say, hey, this is hard. I really don't know what to say, but I want you to know that I'm here and I'm going to stay here with you as long as you want me to.
Let me quote something that you write in your book. Dying is the most intimate act we will undertake. It requires us to be intimate with ourselves, our bodies, our lives, and with the present moment, to reveal the parts we believe are difficult to love, the face beneath the mask we wear for the outside world, and the squishy parts that bear wounds and form scars. Everything else is a show. And I really like that partial paragraph there. I just think it speaks to what we're talking about, how complicated it is, but also how sort of simple it is. And on the other hand,
it's actually so simple.
It's so simple.
It is. It is. But it just feels really complicated because we are so complicated, you know. But when I can allow myself to be fully vulnerable, I think I allow myself to have love poured into those parts that I think are hard to love. You know, when I can let somebody see them and they don't reject me and they stay and they continue to love me, then I think, well, maybe those parts are lovable too. Dying is an incredibly intimate act. Every part of myself will be on display. You'll see, I mean, somebody's going to go through all my stuff for starters. You're going to open
That's all right.
My drawers, everything.
All your secrets, right? As you hid away.
All of my secrets. Everything's going to come out.
Yeah.
And now since I'm dead, people are going to tell the things I told them never to tell because now it's safe to do so, except I'm going to come back and haunt them. But everything is on display when we're dying. We are the most vulnerable that we will ever be. Bodies aren't working the way that they used to anymore. Once I die, I'm going to be laying someplace cold and naked on the slab somewhere. Somebody's going to go through my body and eventually, you know, do something with it and eventually bury me or so. Like, I'm going to be bare. Let me practice.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of secrets and these intimate moments, you give all the people in your book pseudonyms, but you talk about a woman named Dora who admitted, I guess, to you that she had children, but she never wanted to have children. And this was a secret for obvious reasons that she had kept to herself, but she shared it. And what did that mean to her? What did it mean to her children?
It was a tough one for her to admit. And I'll also just tell you right now that since my book came out, so many women have pulled me aside or whispered to me across a book signing table or in the airport, I didn't want to either.
Wow.
And yeah, because societally, you know, culturally, it's a thing that we're supposed to want to do. And particularly people with uteruses, that's what you're supposed to want to do with them. Dora's admission nearing the end of her life, it looked like she had lost 10 years, you know, when she finally said it. And as we talked about it, it became clear that she'd really wanted to be the successful career woman, which she was, but she felt burdened and weighted by children and by the expectation that their children be the center of her life, which they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that she didn't love them. It's not that she didn't care for them. She just really did not like the job of mothering. She didn't like the role of mother. She wanted something else for her life instead.
Yeah.
I think
they weren't enough. They weren't enough for her.
Yeah. And I think that they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be everything. But they weren't. She wanted more. She wanted more. And for women of that generation, it was hard to admit. I think maybe it's a little bit easier now, perhaps. And like I said, many, many people have come and shared with me after the fact that it's not what they want for their lives in totality either.
Did she tell her children, or did they learn that she?
No.
I mean, some secrets. You know, you don't have to tell all the secrets, right?
You don't have to tell them to all the people.
Right. But she told you.
She told me. And when I say visibly unburdened, like it just felt like a weight had been lifted off of her. She's probably been carrying it her entire life. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the children felt it in some way.
Yeah. I mean, guilt can do that, right?
Absolutely. She did the best that she could to provide for them and to give them these experiences in life. And by virtue of working meant that she had more money and more access and so was able to provide these things for her kids. But they were the typical latchkey kids of the 80s. Yeah.
You talked about the body, and it's, you know, we are our body, but you describe our body as our most trustworthy companion. And I think anyone that ages, you know, you see bodily changes, some of them more horrifying than others. But the death is about the body, right?
Yeah. When I talk about death, I'm talking about experience of the body because I have no evidence for, or nothing solid to base any questions about what happens to a consciousness afterwards. So when I'm talking about death, I'm talking about the body in particular. As we age, you know, the bodies start to do some interesting things. I'm 46 and in process now, honey. I'm always like, wait, what is that? What's going on there?
Yeah, how did that happen?
How did that happen?
Right.
How did that happen? And as we age, it's like just opportunities to be with the fact that all of us at some point, if we are lucky enough, will come apart and weaken and slowly decay and deteriorate and eventually die. Yikes.
Yeah.
But it's the truth.
Yeah, but you also say we need to befriend our body because it's, you know, it's the thing that's carrying us through life.
This body carries out so many functions for me that I am not anywhere near aware of. Just trillions of things are happening all the time that allow me to be present, allow me to be here. But similarly, so I trust the body to do all these things for me all the time, right? Every day, to wake me up, to turn me on, digestive enzymes, to process my food, good bacteria in the gut, bad bacteria, all the things, immune system, things are working consistently. And I trust that implicitly. I can't not. Even people that live with, you know, chronic illness at some point have to trust some versions of their bodies, even though some things don't work the way that they're supposed to. Now, at some point, that means I must also trust that the body can no longer, that it has done the best that it can. It has fought disease. It has, you know, sent as many of the white blood cells to the place that it needs to, but it's reached its end, and so it must die. So I have to trust that as well, and that's really tough. But if I can trust it to make me live, if I can trust it to carry me through, if I can trust it to help me drive, I can trust it to say, I'm done.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Alua Arthur. She is a death doula, and she's also an author. Wrote a book called Briefly Perfectly Human, subtitled Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End. And much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest, Alua Arthur, thinks about and talks about death a lot. She's an end-of-life doula, helping the dying find some semblance of peace as they go through the dying process. Her book, Briefly Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End, is part memoir. And it's also full of really moving stories about what people want in their final days. She has an organization called Going with Grace, where she provides end-of-life planning, training, and support. And we are talking about how to embrace our mortality. Picking up about bodies and the kind of intimacy when you're with someone who is dying or has died. And someone was just telling me about a loved one who died, and the family washed the body. I mean, the body was dead. and they washed the body and how meaningful that was. Can you speak about that?
That just lit my heart up to hear that.
I saw it on your face.
Yeah, and then I felt like a total weirdo for smiling so
You did. You were smiling very broadly. Yes, that's okay.
Very, very broadly.
Yeah.
Because it warms my heart. It's so intimate and loving and caring. When people are with serious disease, they have caregivers around them, yeah, because they can't take care of themselves anymore. And those caregivers handle all of their daily needs. And after the death occurs, there's nothing left for the caregivers to do. It can be really tough. If anybody has been in the experience of caring for somebody in their end, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The death occurs and it's like, well, now what? How beautiful it is to get to provide this last act of care, to wash a body.
Yeah.
And I don't mean, you know, full shower, but just an act of ritual to cleanse the body of maybe some of the bacteria that's on it, to provide love again, to hold this body in honor. When I'm supporting family members or caregivers as they're doing it, I ask them to hold memories of each part of the body as they're doing it. It's a beautiful act that that folks are able to carry out. But I also want to couch it in cultural understandings, because in some parts of the world, this is an act that is taken by the lower class or lower caste of people. It's not an act of honor. But the way that I see it and the way that the folks that I work with have been doing it, it's a very loving ritual to undertake at the end.
And touch, right. Touch both ways. I mean, even if someone has died, to be able to hold their hand or touch their skin.
Yeah. And to look at them again and look at all their little wrinkles and look at their smile lines and think about how many times they smiled at you, or, you know, to also look at their hands and think about how they held your hand, and also recognizing that this is going to be the last time that you do. I think it's also a crucial element in grieving, or can be really helpful in that, to actually say goodbye to the body that housed, you know, the whole human, that housed your love, that housed your dreams or your hopes or whatever else that body housed, to say goodbye to it, touch it.
Yeah. I've been with people when they have taken their last breath, and they're really, it's just shocking, but there is a before and after. That before the breath, they are alive. After that breath, they're dead. And you can see it. I mean, you can see all of a sudden, this is a dead person.
Isn't that wild?
It is wild.
Yeah, that just on a breath, the body goes from being this animated, no matter how much energy the person had before, based on their level of disease, or if it was sudden, this animated being into now just matter. You can tell it's just now flesh and tissue, and it happens so quickly. It's also, I feel so honored to see it, but this really hits back to that mystery, because how does that occur so rapidly?
Yeah, and it really is a before and an after. I mean, that's what's so kind of amazing about that. You know, not all families can come together and grieve as one and, you know, put mom or dad, whoever is the dying person, to rest, or even put the family conflicts to rest. How do you suggest people deal with, and in some ways they are often inevitable, the things that are going to come up when a loved one is dying in the family?
Those can be some of the most conflict-ridden times. My invitation to everybody is to acknowledge that the place that they're coming from is probably a place of grief, and that the person who is sitting opposite you in the conflict is probably also deeply grieving. So once we can establish that as a baseline, I think it gives a little bit more space for people to be in their emotion about it, because anger is often grief. You know, this is the way that it needs to be. Control is often grief. Any stagnant energy about it, also grief. Lack of movement, likely grief also. And so if we can acknowledge that everybody's grieving as a baseline, it makes it a little bit easier. One of the things that I like to do when I am called into a family or a unit in order to support is, first of all, acknowledge that everybody's grieving and see if we can find some commonalities in the things that they are requesting, to see what the root of it is. And often the root is, I want her, the person who died, to have the best experience possible right now. So if we can see, find some common ground on that, then we can, you know, maybe argue the details a little bit easier.
I know people who've had difficult relations, often with parents, you know, difficult and sort of unresolved conflicts with parents. But once the parent has died, they're able in their own way to create a better relationship with them. Someone I know says, well, he's dead and he can't hurt me anymore. So I can sort of create this, maybe it's a fantasy parent, but I can sort of take the good parts and make that my parent that I can then love maybe more in death than in life.
Absolutely. That is something that I see a lot of adult children or children who have had difficult relationships with their parents do, is to think about the things that actually worked for them away from the things that were very difficult or painful. Additionally, I think that when folks have a difficult relationship with somebody and the death occurs and there wasn't an opportunity for reconciliation, that they create it within themselves somehow. You know, we often think forgiveness is something that has to be, you know, stated or given or has to be said to the person. But sometimes that can happen internally. We don't often need the other person in order to experience it. Mm-hmm. And also sometimes people choose not to forgive. And that can also be healing for them. And I'm down for that, too.
Sure.
I think a lot of folks that do death work or in the death space, we talk a lot about forgiveness and reconciliation. But, you know, you can hold on to it till the day you die as well. And if that serves you, more power to you. I'm down for that as well.
You know, I was thinking, this is a bit of a segue, but I was thinking, you know, many of us bring animals into our lives, whether they're dogs or cats or hamsters or horses or goldfish. And generally, the animals in our lives are going to die before we do. We love them, and then they die, and then we get another animal, we bring it back into their lives, and we go through that again. Is living with animals that maybe live a decade or so, is that a kind of practice session for death?
It is. It's so masochistic. I don't understand how y'all do it.
I've spent my whole life falling in love and then having my heart broken and doing it all over again.
Over and over. Wow. I'm with friends who are like on their third or fourth at this point, and I'm thinking, great, here we go. It's just a couple of years until we are devastated yet again. I think it's so beautiful. Yeah. I think it's so beautiful. It also requires a bit of, I think, amnesia about the grief in order to fully take it on. And yes, massive practice, incredible practice, because you're in the process of loving and caring, and then dying is occurring. And then you grieve, and then you get up and you do it again. Right. It also, I think, harkens to the incredible resilience that humans have, you know, the choice to love over and over and over again, regardless of the circumstances and regardless of the fact that death will occur. That's what we're doing with each other all the time. You know, we fall in love, we get married, we say those words till death do us part, knowing damn well that at some point somebody's going to die and that's going to hurt a lot, but we do it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. That's often in those traditional marriage vows, till death do us part.
Death.
Speaking of love, you say you have learned at the end of life that there are sort of three questions that people have. Who did I love? How did I love? And was I loved? Very profound, obviously, but did that strike you? Did that surprise you? What does that mean? What are we saying about ourselves?
What I've surmised is that we're saying that love seems to be the center, and the loving experience in our relationship seems to be the center of our lives. Folks are often grappling with these questions, getting close to the end. You know, people are thinking about their time and how they spent it and how they showed up in life, but also who are the people, you know, who was around me? Who do I want to forgive, or who do I need to ask for forgiveness from, or who loved me? Who did I hurt? Who do I need to thank? Who was I in relationship with? And how did I show up? Now, the most challenging for me is often the question, was I loved?
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. But sort of, was I loved the way I wanted to be loved, right?
And the way I was.
And the way I was, exactly.
And the way I was. Yeah. I feel so, you know, proud, for lack of a better word, of those folks that weren't receiving love in the way that they wanted in either their families of origin or their communities, and struck out to go find it in a way that worked for them. Those are the people that, as they're approaching the end, that question, was I loved, when there is a resounding yes, I was, it feels so good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You write, and I just think it's important to underscore this, that we generally approach death the way we have approached life. Is that that's one of your things that you have learned as a death doula and being with people as they have been dying?
It's a large continuum.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily the opposite side of the coin, but just the continuum. And so I'm living all the way up until the time that I'm dead. You know, I'm living even as I'm dying. And then I approach my death the same way. Mm-hmm. So I see folks that either were in resistance and were trying to control and were angry and frustrated their entire lives take that same thing into their death. Mm-hmm. Or folks that were generally laissez-faire, we take it as it is. You know, they probably also will take it as it is. It is what it is. Those folks in my life, I can imagine that as their dying comes around, they're going to be like, well, here we are. It is what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
One is not better than another, I want to be clear. One is not better than the other.
But it's just a sort of who we are as a living and a dying person, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, and a big part of my work is honoring the individual lived experience for exactly who that individual was. And so if that person wants to control everything, I also am like, what a sweet baby. How precious. Let's do our best all the way until the end.
You know, it's interesting that there are more states, I don't have the exact number, but more states are enacting right to die laws, which is, you know, it's complicated. It's not a simple thing, but nonetheless, we're seeing that more people want to have some either say or control or choice over how they die. As someone who, this is your work, does this surprise you? What does it tell you about us people? As human beings,
it encourages me as human beings. To me, it's a big act of compassion to say, I may not understand your struggle and your experience, but I can hear that you don't want to be alive anymore, and I don't have to try to fix it for you, and I don't have to make it better. If this is what you choose to do with your life, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's an agency. My work is all around agency, and the human right to self-determine. What they want to do, who they want to be, what clothes they want to wear, how they want to show up in their life. Certainly that extends into how they die. At last count, I think it was 11 states in the District of Columbia, and their organizations such as Compassion and Choices that are working really, really hard to make this happen. And I am a big supporter and fan. Now, I must say, I don't know that I would choose it for myself, and yet I want somebody to have the right to choose if they want.
Do you find your work depressing, inspiring? I mean, I must say that I have been at funerals and with people who are dying where we are laughing our heads off, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
But is your work sad? Do you feel sad?
Sometimes I feel sad, but mostly I feel grief, which I think is kind of different than sad. You know, I feel a loss of somebody because I come to care for my clients and then they die and there is a loss there. But I wouldn't say that my work is depressing. In fact, I find it to be very life-affirming and invigorating. It allows me to be far more present in my own life. It allows me to be more compassionate, to allow human to just be exactly who they are. It also allows me to, you know, eat more chocolate cake and just allow myself to, you know, do what I want with my life.
You make an interesting distinction between compassion and empathy. And I always think of empathy as sort of feeling with, you know, feeling like that's like the most sort of highest level of care, but you make an interesting distinction there.
Yeah, I think it's compassion rather, because empathy tries to put ourselves in the shoes of another to understand, to be in their experience. But when somebody is actually facing the end of their life, I have no idea. I have no lived context for it, you know? With compassion, I don't have to understand what your experience is, but I can still be down for you in it. I can still be there with you in it. And to me, that seems to be quite healing in the experience as people are dying, but also in the experience as I watch people in war-torn areas. I don't know what that's like. I haven't lived it in my own life to be struggling and starving and famine, yet I can still say, gosh, that's really tough. Compassion is the place that moves folks, I believe.
About a minute or so before we have to say goodbye, what's in a doula bag of tricks?
Oh, some phrases for sure. Like, this sucks. Sometimes a little bit more colorful language.
Yeah.
There's some ritual items, like a singing bowl and maybe some incense. There's books of poems. But mostly there is an open heart There is a really soft front for people to land on and a strong back so that can hold them up. There are loving hands for a touch. There are certainly tissues. There are a lot of hugs. There's some laughter. There's some humor. And I think ultimately there's humanity at the core. That's in the doula bag of tricks.
There's also washcloths, hair ties. I mean, just to be totally practical here, right?
Practical. Yes. There are washcloths. There are hair ties. There are Q-tips. There are cotton balls. There's rubbing alcohol. There's lotion. There's Aquaphor for dry lips or cuticles or feet. There's smell goods for anointing after the body dies. There's a hairbrush. There's dry shampoo for people whose hair allows dry shampoo.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of practical items for caring for bodies.
Well, Eluwa Arthur, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for the work that you do and for joining us today on The Connection. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Marty. This was fun.
It was fun. I know. We promised our listeners it was going to be fun, and it was. And again, Eluwa Arthur, our guest, she is a death doula, wrote a book called Briefly Perfectly Human, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs Friday and Sunday at noon on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcast. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Debbie Builder produces The Connection with Paige Murray Bessler, our engineer Al Banks. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.